Hello, welcome to Left Ungagged, the pro-independence podcast for lefties. It's been a very busy week this week. There's been a lot going on. On Tuesday with the Queen's speech, a lot of measures in that from the Johnson regime. Old Lizzie read out how they were going to be cracking down on immigrants, protecting war criminals, giving Boris the power to call elections and making it harder for people to vote in elections. We had the swearing in of MSPs in the new Scottish Parliament, and we've got a new presiding officer, a Green MSP, for the first time. Then on Thursday, we were all heartened to see the good people of Glasgow South Side rally around to protect their neighbours from the Home Office who had came to deport them. We also had a Westminster by-election. I think we all thought we were done with elections for a wee while, but just 1 week after the Scottish Parliament elections, we had a by-election and Airdrie shots. And we finished off the week with Rangers fans rioting and rampaging through the city centre. I'll be your host today, David McClement. I'm transmitting from the Blantyre Free State. And I'm the only member of the Green Party that doesn't own a bike. I'll be introducing my two friends in a moment. Joining me today is my good friend. She's the eighth most electable SNP member in the West of Scotland. She's Mulgaes Digital Michelangelo, Miss Deborah Torns. You want to say hello, Deborah?
Hello, how are you doing?
And also joining us is, when he's not jet-setting between Dundee and Torrevieja, he's Falkirk's Pizza Hut Prince, the wee ginger sociologist, Brian Stewart Findlay. Welcome, Brian.
Hello. Hi, thanks for having me.
So, we were saying that it might be a quieter podcast this week compared to last week where we had all the election results, but no, it's not going to be the case. There's a hell of a lot to talk about. First up, there was Queen's speech, which seems quite a long time ago now, last Tuesday. There was a lot in it. We'll not have time to go into everything in detail because you could do a couple of podcasts on just that itself. So what were people's thoughts? What jumped out for you guys? Brian, do you want to go first?
I mean, the media coverage of it was focusing very much on the voter ID, which I know we'll go into in quite a lot of detail. And there was a few other bits and pieces. There was the real lack of discussion around employment, I think, was something that a lot of people were noticing. There was basically nothing really for in terms of an employment bill. Obviously, other key takeaways for me, actually going back and actually reading the Queen's speech. I don't watch it. I read it. And
Disrespectful.
It's so disrespectful. It's not very patriotic of me, but I read it. And, you know, it was really the things about the sort of procurement bill was a real concern, you know, removing more red tape around public service contributions is really concerning. So that would be the kind of main takeaways for me, particularly around the sort of voter restrictions as well.
Deborah, what are your thoughts?
It's the procurement bill, but I think you've got that later on in the agenda, and the free ports.
Yes.
It's a bit sketchy, isn't it? I don't know, I didn't watch it either. I feel that it's a bit weird that she doesn't even write her own speech. It's just like the Tories' agenda, really, isn't it? That she repeats back to. So I didn't really like the overhaul of the asylum system either. That was a bit
sinister.
Like, yeah, there's, what other word can you use to describe it? Nasty. It's they're going to discourage migrants from crossing the channel. And it's like, well, if you're in such a situation where you need to get in a dinghy to go across one of the busiest stretches of shipping lanes with your family, I think, you know, instead of being met by a border force on the beach, you should probably be met with a blanket and a cup of tea. That's just
well,
me.
Of course, the real way to discourage people from getting in dinghies to cross the channel is to give them a safe way to cross the channel. But I somehow don't think that's what Boris and Priti Patel have got in mind. I think probably they've got some, well, before they were talking about some high-tech wave machine. So what, basically it capsized.
What, like at the time capsule?
Maybe
a, A wave machine? Really? Is that?
Yeah,
real?
Yeah, that was getting talked about. I don't even know if that's real, if it's a real thing, or if it was just them brainstorming something at the thick of it.
Yeah, talking about, like, you know, safe passageway into the UK and things like that, like, perhaps that, you know, the UK government and the British state in general should stop creating hostile environments, both within the UK itself, but also abroad, that makes people want to leave where they are. So, you know, we can take, you know, four or five steps back with this issue of trying to discourage people about taking dangerous crossings across the English Channel. It's like, well, let's prevent them from having to leave where they come from in the first place. And if they do want to come here, let's just make it safe and welcoming for people, exactly. You know?
Yeah, if you want to discourage large-scale migration, the first thing you could do is try to make the world a more stable place, which has
absolutely
not really been British foreign policy, well, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I also liked that the Queen mentioned 5G. That was good. I was like, upset the conspiracy theorists. It's called the Telecommunications Security Bill, I think.
You know, she was wearing that big fancy hat to deflect the 5G signals herself, you know?
The Product Security and Telecommunications Infrastructure Bill, and it's extending 5G mobile coverage and will introduce new safety standards for all digital devices. But I think the conspiracy theorists will get quite excited about that.
Yeah, they'll love that.
The other one that I thought, that's a wee bit under the radar, was the dissolution and calling of Parliament Bill.
Yes.
It'll get rid of that fixed 5-year term.
Yeah, until I was reading that, I hadn't actually heard any mention of that in any of the reports about the Queen's speech.
That was sneaky, wasn't it?
It seems interesting that the media have really homed in, probably rightly so, on the, you know, the idea for voting and things like that. But I think that there was very, you know, just from what I read anyway, there was very little delving into some of these really, really important issues, you know, about, you know, you're talking about the fixed, you know, the fixed term Parliament Act and things like that, that, you know, if you wanted to look for them, they were sort of in the last paragraph. And this was also included, you know, it's, you know, quite bad.
Yeah, it's a little bit Trumpian in the sense of, you know, there's quite a few things in this that in a normal Queen's speech would be very controversial, but pack in five or six controversial things and people can only get angry at one at a time. So while we're all arguing about the voter ID, you know, it's quietly in the background, they're putting in legal protections for British soldiers that commit war crimes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that would be headline in any Queen's speech, you would think, but stick in enough other controversial things and they can't focus on everything.
And it's true, like, it really has sort of dominated the narrative, and from, you know, because there's not enough stress in my life, I watch Question Time every week just so I'm in touch with what people are, you know, what's the sort of mainstream narrative, what are people just bickering and arguing about, you know, now that, you know, Brexit's done, what are people arguing about now? And really it was, they had an SNP member, so they're talking about, you know, does the SNP have a mandate or whatever, but the actual voter ID dominated quite a lot of that discussion. Without even mentioning some of these things that we're talking about now, you know. So it seems to be that the media sort of picked up that as the main thing that they want to focus on. And that seems to be where the narrative is sort of centering around is the sort of voter ID thing, which is terrible, but in itself, you know, it's quite telling.
Definitely. The fact that there wasn't more discussion about the free ports, like it was sort of hailed at the beginning of Brexit as, oh, this is the solution for everything. But really, it's just Mos Eisley, isn't it? You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious. Like, it's just a haven for, you know, tax evasion and avoidance and potential criminality. I think we really need to be talking about that a bit more. What is the UK post-Brexit going to actually become? Are we just going to become this place where you can go and buy very, very expensive things but just keep them off, you know, in these freeport areas?
It's really, really concerning. And there's a really good article that was written, I think it was in October last year, by Mikey Chapman in The Courier about freeports, because Dundee City Council sort of been floating the idea of the freeport in Dundee.
Just to make it clear, I think this, the Tories have said they're going to start 8 free ports in England.
Eight.
Seven or eight, is it? But yeah, Dundee's been floated as as being a possible future Freeport. So it's obviously relevant to you, Brian, living up in that area.
Yeah, I can see the port from the flat. And yeah, like some of the arguments that we've sort of touched on is the issue around criminality, but also the sort of potential driving down of workers' rights, the people that work there, is also a real concern. Also the fact that ports can actually be used for something that's much, much more positive, particularly if we're talking about in the northeast of Scotland, decommissioning of the North Sea oil, for example, is, you know, we should be using them for creating good quality, sustainable jobs that's going to help with the climate crisis, rather than saying, you know, you can stick whatever you want in there and you don't have to pay, you know, tax and things towards it. It's just, you know, let's actually use them for something that is, that's going to provide good quality jobs, actually going to help towards some of the really big issues that we face as a country.
Yeah, I found the some of the discussion about Freeport's a bit baffling. I can't remember where I read it, but this it was clearly they were pro-Tory, because they were saying, oh, Boris is being really clever here. He's laying out things and he's going left-wing in some issues like Freeport's. And I thought, I don't know an awful lot about Freeports, but nothing about them sounds particularly left-wing to me. I mean, they sound like Adam Smith's wet dream.
They are. They are.
Yeah.
It's basically, yeah, complete deregulation, and just makes it easier for people to, you know, ship things to a Freeport and they can sit there and then you can ship them back out again. And it is literally just a neoliberal, you know, free market ideology in one location. So it's definitely not left-wing. It's certainly not going to be positive for people in and around Dundee that's going to provide the really good sustainable jobs that we need, particularly in this area.
And yet again, coming from a government that is obsessed with controlling their borders, they're now happy to concede control over parts of their borders as long as it's involving money and not people.
Exactly.
Yeah, and for a government who loves to talk about tax, it doesn't seem like it marries up to their ideology, really. It's like there's almost just, and of course it will probably help their business interests, won't it?
Yeah, it's, well, their ideology is probably dictated by who's willing to donate the most money to the Tory party. So there's clearly a lot of money to be made in Freeports for some people, and they've managed to convince, rather at great expense, I'm sure, that the Tories, that's the way to go.
Definitely. Yeah. It certainly seems that way. And I think the main thing is just what I was saying before, is that these ports, which have, you know, sort of been left by the wayside a little bit for a long time and has not really been part of industrial strategy for ages. And now it's like, let's just deregulate them because that's going to benefit everybody. It just seems a bit, you know, it just doesn't really fit together.
Well, a lot of things don't make sense that come out of the UK, to be fair, like the high-speed rail that
they're pushing on with that.
Yeah, that's still happening.
And there's and you see a lot of people criticising the Greens, particularly in England and Wales, for not supporting HS2. And yes, we need new rail infrastructure. Yes, we need, you know, some of the things that HS2 suggests on the tin. But actually, it's not going to benefit people sort of north of Leeds at all,
yeah,
which is really interesting. And that's after, you know, the last scale of it being done. And actually we've gotten seen a really interesting Twitter thread between somebody who was a Lib Dem and somebody who was a Green saying, well, why should we support HS2? And I sort of chipped in and saying, well, even if you get to Leeds and you then have to get the train from Leeds to Edinburgh, it actually doesn't take any time off a journey to London from Edinburgh at all. So, you know, it's very much just a sort of Midlands to South infrastructure plan, really, isn't it? It's
a commuter plan, isn't it? To help,
yes,
you know,
to get people into London
beast
quickly.
Yeah, that's it. Feed the beast that is London.
Yeah, I just Googled there because the numbers and the price tag involved, every time I see it, it's like, it's just numbers that you can't quite get your head around. So the latest estimate is 106 billion with a B. Billion. I mean, that seems a lot of money for a train.
To get people into London quicker.
Yeah. I mean, when you think, you say the Greens in England are getting criticised for not supporting a rail project.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how much green infrastructure could you build for 106 billion?
could have a monorail.
Monorail.
Have a monorail. We could. But yeah, I think as well, the fact it's, you know, and it's always said it's going to be the spine of the UK. So basically it's just going to run up the back and, you know, take people between north and south. But I think that if you're looking at what rail infrastructure could actually be really beneficial for the Greens' ideological stance is to create more movement between towns and things like that, you know. So if you're talking about, you know, in the northeast, the sort of northeast of Scotland rail plan, and it's basically to connect different towns across the way rather than just getting people to go up and down, you know. Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. And Wales as well is another example of where it's had hardly any rail infrastructure. It's not even been electrified yet. So, yeah. You know, actually, see, rather than building this new rail track that's going to get us up and down faster, we'll actually have a sort of more connected view of things, you know?
Yeah, and the southwest of England, I mean, we always kind of talk about the south of England, but really it's the southeast that gets a lot of the money spent on it. The southwest is really poorly connected.
Very bad, yeah.
And that's the thing. It's very rural.
Yeah, if you've got a super duper trade line going north and south, but if everybody has to drive from where they are to get to the kind of central artery to get up and down, it's not going to save much in terms of your carbon footprint.
Absolutely, and the southeast is such a beautiful area of the country. I've only ever been sort of to the southeast once. I made it all the way down to Cornwall 2 years ago. Southwest, sorry. And it's just such a beautiful area and stuff. And to get the train, it takes ages. It's such a long line to get all the way down to Penzance. So absolutely, you know, if you need to have a more joined up thinking and actually think about getting people from different areas rather than just up and down between London, Manchester and all these kind of key points.
Well, they should really be investing more money on their South Coast rail line, because it goes like right along the sea, doesn't it?
It does.
Had a lot of trouble with the tracks being damaged by storms and stuff. So with the ever increasing sea levels rising, should they not be spending a bit more money in that, like you're saying, connectivity between towns and all that? That's much more important than being able to go 5 minutes faster to London. Like, that makes a difference.
So also with the Queen's speech was the Dissolution and Calling of Parliament Bill, which effectively resets us to the situation before 2010, where general elections are in the gift of the Prime Minister rather than having a fixed term. So that was that's one of Nick Clegg's legacies gone. Poor guy didn't have much of a legacy to begin with. But that's another one been binned. This has got a knock-on effect to Scotland, and it shows the lack of interest or care they've got to Scotland, because in Scotland we've just changed the length of our Holyrood terms because they were going to clash with Westminster elections all the time. So they've changed from 4 years to 5 years, and then as soon as we've done that, they've now changed it back, so there could be a general election at any time. And they've already done that before, called elections almost in the middle of a Scottish Parliament campaign.
That was Theresa May, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was the local elections, wasn't it? Because I think that it totally swallowed up that entire local election campaign, because everybody just switched from talking about 2017, and basically it was only a couple of weeks after the local elections, and it just completely swallowed up that whole discussion around local politics, which I think is really, really important during local elections, because you're not fighting, you know, general election wide policies. We're talking about, you know, local infrastructure and local politics. It just totally gets swallowed up. And I think that, you know, if we're going to constantly fluctuate between, you know, different levels of elections in Scotland, between a general election and slotting things in here, I don't think it's good for local election debates and democracy. I think it's really quite damaging.
Yeah, and 4 years, I think, is a better term than 5 years. You know, it allows governments to be held accountable more often. And effectively, in a 20-year span now, we have one less opportunity to do that. And it's just a lack of, you know, respect, interest, care, that just almost on a whim they do that. There obviously was no consultation with any of the sort of devolved governments, because that would be the first thing they would have pointed out, that they had made all these changes based on the Fixed Term Act that they've now binned. We also mentioned earlier the Election Integrity Bill, which is the sort of headline that came out of the Queen's speech. What are people's thoughts on that?
This is a voter ID.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think it's disenfranchises so many people who can get ID. Like, people are like, oh, just get a, you should have your driver's license. Oh, you should have your passport. It's like, you got like 140 quid to get a passport just so you can vote. I don't think it's not fair, and it's very Tory. I don't like it.
It's ideologically very Tory, isn't it? And it's basically addressing a problem that wasn't there in the first place, because I think that, you know, there's different stats floating around, but there's not a lot of people that were actually convicted of voter fraud. I think it was, I've seen ones which is one, two, and then there's four. So we're talking about a handful of people have been convicted for fraud, and anything that has actually been reported, I think there was 150 cases at the last general election, that voter fraud can include a mix-up with people's identification and things like that. So it's a problem that doesn't really exist and that they're trying to address, but perhaps they could actually be looking at, like Scotland has tried to do, is trying to open up so more people can vote. So we've seen in Scotland where, you know, refugees could vote for the first time. We've got votes at 16 and 17 in Scotland and all these types of things. Or they could at least address, you know, the voting system, which is really, really unfair. I just don't think that this is the most important thing that needs to be dealt with when we talk about, you know, the voting system or how we operate the processes in voting. I just don't, this isn't even on the radar as a priority.
Yeah, it's very US Republican. They've been going down this route for quite a long time now, where they constantly talk about voter fraud, despite the fact there's statistically insignificant amounts of it happen. But this could be the first stage. You know, and what they've done, the Republicans have done a lot of places as well, is they dress it up as a cost-cutting measure where they shut down polling stations and have less and less polling stations. So you get situations where it's not uncommon to have to queue up for several hours to vote in parts of America. And it also, by coincidence, a lot of time the Republicans happen to be in areas that are heavily Democratic or get large ethnic minority populations that obviously don't really vote Republican. And it just makes me wonder if they're being advised in this. We've saw them sort of get into the culture wars a lot more, the Tories, in the last few years, which is straight out of the sort of Republican playbook. And I just wonder what's next. Hopefully this can be stopped, because it's just wrong. You know, we should be making it easier and easier for people to vote. We shouldn't be putting barriers.
Exactly.
No, I completely agree.
Okay, one of the things that wasn't in the Queen's speech that people expected was a ban in conversion therapy, which they announced that they were going to consult on that, which I didn't think we were still debating whether conversion therapy was okay, but they kicked it into the long grass. So be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Aye, they sort of dressed it up as just in the preamble before, you know, the actual Queen's speech came out. They said that it was, they didn't want to stop pastors or priests, ministers, you know, religious clergy from having conversations with people who were concerned about their sexuality. But if you read more into it, because that you know, that doesn't seem a bad thing, you know, a bit of counselling if you're trying to come to terms with who you are as a person. But that wasn't how they were selling it. They were selling it about, you know, they're going to give you advice that you're going to go to the bad burning fire for being a gay man or a gay woman or, you know, bi, trans, whatever. It's just, it's very uncomfortable to even talk about it, to be honest. I mean, it's 2021 and we're still having these discussions. It's like, what is wrong with us?
No, I very much agree with what you're saying. And I think what's really important here is if we're talking about like clergy of any kind or somebody who's essentially in a position of power, I think that if somebody's seeking support, it's essentially coercion. And that's what we're essentially allowing to happen. If you're somebody who is confused or wanting support or to discuss their sexuality with somebody that they trust, then you're essentially putting yourself in the hands of somebody who has power. And if they are allowed to coerce people or try and encourage them to take certain routes. That is extremely problematic. And I think that we need to view this discussion around conversion therapy in that context.
Yeah, some I've noticed as well is the terminology around this, and maybe I'm just reading too much into it, but you know, everybody knew what conversion therapy was when it was referred to, but I've noticed they've started referring to it as gay conversion therapy. And I wonder if that is that a subtle way of sort of confusing the sort of wider population that it's the opposite of what it is that conversion therapy is trying to make people gay. Do you think I'm too paranoid there? But gay conversion therapy doesn't sound like what it is. It sounds the opposite.
Is it trying to like compartmentalize it a wee bit? And I think this is what could be really, really problematic, right? So if we're talking about conversion therapy, I think classically everybody knows what it means. So it means that, you know, to basically prevent someone from being gay, which we know is not possible, right? We know that's not possible. But I think what also that falls within that is looking at gender and stuff as well. And I think that's what's really quite problematic, is that actually what conversion therapy is trying to do is instill heteronormative expectations on society. That's the problem. So if it means that if we're talking about sexuality or we're talking about gender or whatever it is or everything in between, that's problematic. And I think that, you know, setting heteronormative expectations is the sort of starting point for that. So what converting you back to the center ground, that's just really makes me feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah, and that's the thing. If you lived in a society that wasn't still so heteronormative, mm-hmm. you know, there would be no need for people to go seeking support, because people wouldn't struggle with it. Because people struggle with it because there's certainly elements of society that that still tell them that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. And this is the problem, you know. It goes down to the, you know, the Thai inclusive education campaign that we have in Scotland, and that's kind of centering and embedding inclusiveness in the education system. So if people are feeling, oh, perhaps I might be gay, or I might be bisexual, or I might be pansexual, or my gender, I don't feel that my gender matches with who I'm supposed to be, and you've got inclusivity in that education, then there's nothing wrong with that, you know. And I think the feeling that something is wrong, I think that's the really problematic thing when it comes to mental health and when it comes to people actually, you know, actually being their authentic self. And you know, I think that this is where we're kind of taking a step backward with this discussion around conversion therapy, because yes, it should be banned. Yes, it's coercive, but also we should stop, you know, that as if, the, you know, being a heterosexual person who is of the same gender that they were assigned at birth is, you know, the perfect solution to life, because it's not the standard. That's what I'm trying to get to. And this is where, you know, we need to remove the standard completely and say, well, you are who you are, and everybody should be supported in being that, you know, rather than trying to coerce people to be a certain way.
For me, I find it quite a recent phenomenon. Because I remember speaking to my friend nearly a decade ago about it, and he was a member of parliament, and he was like, I've not really heard anything about this. He was also involved in a lot of his the religious community, he was like, I don't think this is happening, Deborah. And I kept saying, well, I keep hearing about these smaller churches, and this is something that's going on, and the congregation prays for the gay person and, you know, to save their soul and all that. It's a bit dodgy. And I wonder if it is very much linked to the transphobic discourse that we've been hearing, that there's a lot of this, there's a gay agenda and we're all trying to turn the whole world a big massive rainbow. And, you know, back in my day there weren't so many gays, back in my day there weren't so many trans folk. And I think you've got to look upon that with a sort of cautious eye, because I think the, you know, having a religious community, I myself went to Church of Scotland a lot, went to Sunday school and all that, but it was never preached to me you know, about being somehow being gay was sinful. But there was that heteronormality of, you know, get married and have the children and all that. I think you make brilliant points there, Brian. I just worry that, like what David was saying, how they're trying to separate it as gay conversion therapy, which I think sounds fantastic, to be honest. I think we should all be converted to being gay. That's the gay agenda talk. But I think it's probably to, as you say, compartmentalize it all and just be like, aye. It was a good spot, David.
Take the T out of LGBT.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else in the Queen's speech we've not really touched upon. I think anything else that you guys want to talk about? I think we've covered most of what I noticed.
I think we've done the whistle stop tour of the sort of the main ones. I think that just touching back to what I mentioned at the start, there was the obvious omission of anything to do with employment, I think, which is extremely problematic. And I think that as we kind of move forward into this Brexit Britain or whatever it's going to look like, because that seems, you know, the whole employment market around what the UK labour market is going to look like post-Brexit hasn't really been discussed yet. And as obviously somebody who's interested in employment, it's something that I've been looking out for. And there's not much on it at all. And that in itself is worrying.
Not just post-Brexit, but post-pandemic. Like,
absolutely.
It's a cataclysm of, you know, two events that nobody's talking about.
Absolutely. And I think that where employment, you know, if there's no proper interventions within employment, and that would be the preferred option, I'm assuming, of Tories because of the very much how lax a lot of these things are, there is going to have to start being real interventions from Holyrood where they can. Obviously, they don't have power over employment, but what they do have now is power over giving businesses money. And they can actually start to put clauses within that. And this was actually in the Greens manifesto, is to say, well, do you know what? Businesses have been reliant on these sort of business funds through COVID and things like that, but they can easily put clauses into that by saying you cannot use 0-hour contracts, for example. You cannot use X, Y, and Z. These are the types of things that the Scottish Government needs to start looking at, so they can actually start to put positive and progressive interventions in the employment market in Scotland.
Also, that happened this week was we had the swearing in of the new Scottish Parliament, and we had a new presiding officer being elected.
Yay!
Which was Alison Johnston, who is the first Green presiding officer in the history of the Scottish Parliament. So, did any of you guys watch the kind of some of the swearing in ceremonies?
I saw some of them. I liked Maggie Chapman. She was swore in and Show Me. Is that how
Shona.
You pronounce it? Shona. That was really great. And I liked hearing all the Scots dialects and Gaelic. And it was lovely. And we also had a Sikh woman elected to Parliament. That was nice as well. And just, I think we had some great achievements just as a Parliament in itself. We done some great stuff and it was really nice to listen to all the people getting sworn in. I was disappointed there was no replication of Rosie Kane's, you know, hat, but that is iconic. Can't match that really, can you? You're just copying it if you do it. But all the Greens, they all said we swear it and we do this under protest, didn't they?
It was great.
Yeah, it's still ludicrous that everybody's elected has to swear allegiance to Mrs. Windsor and her heirs and successors, but it does leave a chance to create a wee bit of protest there with the affirming that it's under protest. Did you watch it, Brian?
Do you know what, to say that I was really sad is I actually watched them all, right? So I watched it in real time as well, just because, I don't know why. I think it was raining at that time and I was like, I'm just going to pop on Scottish Parliament TV and watch this. I didn't watch the Queen's speech, but I did watch the swearing in. And it was really good to see the diversity of the Parliament. And I think that when we had the discussion last Sunday, I didn't think we quite saw exactly how diverse the parliament was. I think we were very much in the thick of the numbers and the arithmetic. But I think it's the most diverse parliament in terms of gender equality, which is great. And you could see that during the swearing-in process because we've become so accustomed to just expecting it being man, 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 women, man, man, you know. And I think that that's really, really good to see the gender diversity there. Plus, we've got Pam Duncan-Glancy as well, which is a really, really good iconic moment, I think, for disabled people. And I think that you know, it's a really, really representative parliament. We saw that with the different languages that were being said, and it was actually quite a positive and uplifting experience to see all the, you know, the sort of the variety of different types of people. And I think that even though that the actual arithmetic of the parliament hasn't changed that much, I think that the actual people that are in that parliament has actually changed quite significantly, and I think that it will be much, much better for debate going forward, I think.
Yeah, there was a lot of the sort of class of 99 MSPs that have been there a long time. A lot of them sort of stood down. Well, mostly in the SNP side, because a lot of the Labour ones lost their seat a few elections ago. So yeah, as much as it was almost exactly the same in terms of party balance, it's a lot of new people and a lot of diversity. I don't think it's quite gender balanced yet, but I think it was mid to high 40%.
It's 45-ish, and 45. I can't remember exactly. 45-55, which is the best one we've had so far. Getting there. And the Greens group is really quite, I think it's heavily skewed towards women, so that's great. It's a really, really positive thing.
So, yeah, first women of colour elected. I think it was Pam Goza was the Sikh MSP that you mentioned, Deborah. I'd like to see Anna Sarwar getting sworn in Arabic. I don't know. I remember that before. If he did that before when he was elected,
I don't know.
It's just that in comparison to some of the stuff coming out in this Queen's speech, it felt a lot more progressive,
refreshing, and actually almost like a, you know, you could take a sigh of relief. And I think that after reading, you know, that I was saying just to David off air before we started, is that I actually don't follow Westminster politics that closely, right? Because it stresses me out and it makes me angry. And I think reading the Queen's speech and things like that, I was getting really like, oh, for goodness sake, like, this is terrible. This is really worrying. And then actually moving on to this conversation, it's like you can breathe out and be like, ah, that was really quite positive. That was nice to talk about that. Wasn't that great? Isn't, look at these stats are much, much better. And, you know, having Alison Johnson being elected to presiding officer, it's like, this is all really nice stuff. And it just, I think for me, it just sort of, you know, characterises the difference between Scottish politics, which is far from perfect, compared to Westminster. And I think that, you know, that's something to note in this discussion.
For me, the politics at Holyrood is a lot more inclusive, a lot more cross-party working. And, you know, I just think that you're right. It's refreshing and encouraging. Like, I'm very hopeful for the next session of Parliament and what's going to come out of it and all the things that Scotland can achieve. But when you look at what's happening south of the border, it's like a heavy cloud comes above your head and you're going, oh no, what are they going to come up with next? So I agree with you there, Brian. It's very refreshing.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, we get a new presiding officer. Ken McIntosh, I think, was retiring, and taking over was Alison Johnson. I think from what I heard was because the sort of numbers were quite balanced between the parties, that really none of the parties really were that keen to lose an MSP to the presiding officer's chair. So I think eventually there was some cajoling to convince Alison Johnson to put her name forward, and so she was elected unopposed. I'm not really sure how I feel about having a Green presiding officer. As a Green myself, it seems a wee bit establishment.
Yeah, for me, I was quite surprised that Alison Johnson was one of the people that I had mentioned to Glenn after the election had happened. I was like, I think Alison Johnson is a potential for presiding officer. And I think that it kind of felt like it was done under duress, like you were saying, because the numbers are so tight. But actually, would it have made much of a difference if there was a Tory or if there was a Labour had lost one MSP? Certainly would have made a difference for the Lib Dems. But, you know, for those two parties, Would it actually have made that much of a difference? Probably not. But yeah, I think it does feel a little bit establishment. But ultimately, we've had the parliament since 1999. It's the first time a Green has put it forward. I think every other party the main parties that have sat in there has been a presiding officer. But it's interesting that Alison Johnson, who is a Republican, who makes these statements, you know, when you're being sworn in to vote to the people, is actually going to have to interact with the royal family. And I think that that's quite interesting.
Yeah, another reason why I'm not so keen on it.
But maybe she'll be able to do a protest, like while she's doing it. Like maybe she will only bow her head quite as low or do a curtsy or something. I don't know.
Oh my God, Nicholas Witch will be having kittens.
Definitely. But no, it might be interesting to see how Alison Johnson maybe updates the role slightly or anything like that. And I think it's definitely one to watch, but I think that actually during the election itself was quite interesting too, because everybody supported Alison Johnson, because I think it was a sigh of relief saying, okay, somebody's put themselves forward, we can do it. But there were 31 ballots either against, abstaining or spoiled, and who could that have been?
Yeah.
and they didn't even bother putting their own candidate forward. So the Tories have obviously either voted against, abstained or spoiled the ballot, but didn't actually put anybody forward. So I think that this shows you that the Tories are going to be just as petty as they were in the last parliament. So that was, you know, day one, and we're already rolling our eyes.
They're taking their lead from the leader, who I think is probably the pettiest man in politics, by the sound of it. Did you Definitely. See his spat that he had with Thingy Wishart, the SNP MP?
Oh, Douglas Ross, yeah.
That was embarrassing. And he just kept attacking Pete Wishart that was in the chair. Pete Wishart just kept saying, look, do you want to ask your question here? Or and he just looked like a brat, you know. So
I guess he's very petulant, isn't he? He's a wee spoiled brat.
I don't expect the Tory group to really be anything more than that, because they'll just take the lead for him.
And you can, you know, I think Tories themselves, like, as a petulance, a really good word, because when the Tories try to be, I don't know, sort of agitators or disrupt parliamentary processes, like, you literally are the establishment. Stop trying to play both sides, because it just makes you look ridiculous. You know, last week we were talking about the SNP was really, really popular when they were sort of becoming the agitator and they walked out of parliament and things like that. If the Tories try and do things like that, it's like, you literally are the establishment. Like, why try and agitate people like that? It's just ridiculous.
Well, that's quite common with the right wing. Again, a sort of newish sort of phenomenon where, you know, again, the Republicans in America that try to stand up for the act as if they're the ones that speak for the common man, when really they're in the pockets of the billionaires more than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow they get away with it, so why would they not do it?
What's your sort of concerns then about going back to the presiding officer, Alison Johnson, if you feel uncomfortable about it, which I initially did too, and I'm just interested to see from your perspective what you think.
Yeah, it just is that sort of, it feels very establishment, and I think, you know, other Green parties have sort of moved into coalitions and moved into government and sort of lost that radicalism, and I wouldn't like to see that happen to the Scottish Greens. Also, it weakens the Green group, because technically now they're down to 7 members, so it's really, in a way, I've not really seen what the Greens gain out of it, other than maybe in some way a bit of prestige, but I don't really know how you would quantify that.
No, it's and Alison too is such a really good campaigner on certain things, particularly when it comes to animal rights and things like that, and it would be a shame for her not to be that driving force behind that too. I think that, you know, you make really, really good points, and it's something to keep an eye on, I think, as we go along. So I think, because to me, obviously, I'm a Green, I'm biased, you know, all the Greens bring so much to the group, and just losing somebody particular like Alison Johnson, you know, could be quite problematic. So we'll wait and see.
I see it from a wee bit of a different perspective, obviously, but I think it gives the Greens a wee bit of legitimacy in the eyes of the public. Like, speakers of the House always get a bit more coverage when they say something that's maybe a bit radical, and I can see Alison Johnson not holding back in some situations. I think she'll be great in our new position. I think it's a good thing for you.
I can't help but think, no, there must be a better way of doing it rather than one of the members basically losing, you know, their status as a kind of normal MSP. It seems like a wee bit of a throwback to kind of Westminster, the way Westminster does things.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it should be a separate position?
There's different way, there's different arguments about how you do that. Like, I heard some mentioned that maybe it should be separately elected, but then you don't really want to create another power base with somebody with their own democratic mandate, separate from some like the First Minister and things like that. But I mean, Ken McIntosh was the MSP when he presided over the swearing in of the new MSPs. Why could they not have elected the new presiding officer before the election and then that person doesn't stand as an MSP?
Yeah,
and they can preside over for the 4 years.
Yeah, it's really quite strange, and it's weird in the sort of Westminster system as well, is the fact that the speaker stands and people don't challenge him. It's just,
yeah,
I think that it's actually with removing democracy from people. So if you live in, you know, in John Bercow, what constituency he was in, High Wycombe, it's like nobody opposes him. So what about High Wycombe? You know,
yeah.
It just, to me, it doesn't make much sense. And I think that, you know, Alison Johnson is the first choice in the Green list. She's been elected, you know, several times. She's done a lot for her region and for animal rights and stuff. And then to remove her and put her into the presiding officer thing, I think does a little bit of a disservice to the people of Lothian. And similarly too with the constituency MSP too. So it's interesting. I just think it's, to me, it seems more like a, you know, like a sort of more administrative role. It doesn't, you know, I don't see how, what's the word I'm looking for, but it's, you know, perhaps, you know, being involved in the election process is not something I know a lot about, so I'm just kind of bumping my gums here, but I just think it just seems a bit odd to remove people that have been elected to represent people, to preside over a parliament. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just impressed that you were able to come up with John Bercow's constituency.
It's really sad. I watched quite a lot of stuff. It was High Wycombe. I've got to Google it and double check, but I think it's right.
Sorry.
We know it's right because Brian's a geek.
As long as the listeners don't check, we're fine.
There was a good result for the Westminster by-election, wasn't there, for Anam Kazir Javid?
Yeah, that happened in the same day.
And that's Airdrie & Shotts, SNP win.
Yeah, really low turnout.
Yeah, what was the
really
turnout?
Low turnout?
It was
34.3%.
But then
that's low.
Yeah, I mean, by-elections are always a bit lower, but at the same time, I'm sure they'd be confusing. If you lived in Airdrie & Shotts with the Scottish elections last week, you probably, a lot of people would have mixed up, and a lot of the election stuff they were getting for the by-election, they would have assumed it was for the Scottish Parliament election. So I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't even been aware that this election was going on.
It was very close in time, wasn't it, to the actual... When was the actual
vote?
Exactly a week.
A week, yeah.
So, I mean, if you're going to make it that close, I don't know why they didn't just have it in the same day.
It is a bit strange, especially being, I think it could have been because of the COVID restrictions and the amount of counting and stuff that they had to do. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
possibly.
But the turnout was low. But what's interesting is you can see, because it's actually not that off what a normal by-election would be. Normally, by-elections can be anything between sort of 30 to 40%. But the Hartlepool one was slightly higher than that. I think it was 43%, and that was quite a high-profile one. And there was, you know, so... It's still quite a low turnout, but I'm surprised the low turnout actually went in SNP's favour, because I think that in that area of Airdrie & Shotts that, you know, perhaps people more inclined to vote in a by-election might have been more skewed towards Labour. I don't know. And we can see, similar to the Scottish Parliament elections, that tactical voting, Lib Dem vote down, Tory vote down, Labour up 6%. So I think this is now, and this is what John Curtis was saying on debate night, again, not under stress in my life, I watched that too, is very much that he thinks that's pretty much going to be the staple now of that, the tactical voting for the unionist side. So it's something to be mindful of, and it's appeared again in a Westminster by-election. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on.
I'm surprised there that the SDP got more votes than the Lib Dems. What's going on there?
No, they didn't. They were close. There were 69 votes, I think, behind the Lib Dems.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry, I'm reading.
But again, we're continuing our theme of bashing the Lib Dems. So, candidate Stephen Arundel only get 220 votes. So, not even close to keeping a deposit there. Behind them, they did beat the SDP, the Scottish Unionists, Reform UK, and UKIP. The SDP were the only ones to get three figures there. Until I checked this, I hadn't realised that Reform UK were actually the Brexit Party reformed.
Yeah.
Reformed. So they beat the battle of the Brexiteers. They get 45 votes over UKIP's 39. So UKIP will be gutted that they didn't beat Reform UK there, I'm sure.
But as you said, Brian, for such a low turnout, that's a great result for Annam. 10,129. That's really good.
But I think that with this sort of tactical voting, I think that it's going to be for marginal seats in the next general election for the SNP could be quite problematic because there's some quite close ones. And it seems to be quite localised. Like we saw in the Scottish election, you know, Dumbarton's all swinging behind Labour, you know, in the North East all behind Tory. So voters are actually tapping into local, who do I need to vote for to kick the SNP out? So I think it's something that we'll have to be mindful and keep an eye on, I think, in the next elections to come up. And if there's any by-elections sort of in the next general election.
Of course, if there is another by-election, if the SNP were to take a Labour or Tory seat, it would actually give them a majority. That's how, so you can really see why the SNP wouldn't want to give up one of their seats to the presiding officer's chair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so congratulations, Annam Kisar Javed, the new MP for Airdrie and Shotts.
Yay!
Okay, and again, these are everything we spoke about there after the Queen's speech all happened in the same day, and so did this. So while people were voting in Airdrie and Shotts, and while new MSPs were getting sworn in, a home office van turned up in Kenmure Street to take two asylum seekers away. And this was spotted by a neighbour who I think contacted the Unity Centre, and the local community sprang into action. I think at its height, there was well over 1,000 people there. The one brave guy, I don't know if his name's come out yet, but he climbed under the van for 7 hours in order to stop them driving away. The
legend.
So then eventually, by the end of the day, after 7-8 hours, Police Scotland instructed the Home Office people to release the guys in order to ensure public safety. It was really great to see it unfold in social media. What are your guys' thoughts and feelings about it?
You go first, Deborah.
Well, I have never been so proud to be Glaswegian. It was a beautiful thing to see, and I like to think that anybody would go out and do the same if they saw a van come and kidnap their neighbours, basically. Because what they don't talk about is that the people who were being detained have been in this country for over a decade. Like, the detractors who are like, how can you have these congregations outside in the middle of a pandemic? Well, let me tell you, I think that the circumstances it was called for. You had to do it. You had to block it. And the way that not just the community, but the broader South Side all came together in absolute defiance of what is essentially a horrible, horrible policy coming out of Westminster, which is basically, we're going to detain you, and if you've got any appeals or anything like that, you can do it for inside a cell. Because let's be honest, that's what the detention centre is. It's like a prison. So I say, well done. Hail that hero that climbed under the van. Hail all the people that sat around it. And hail all those people who came together to stop such a terrible thing happening. I'm so proud. Applause for every one of you. Well done.
Just to emphasise exactly what Deborah was saying, and I think, you know, being up in Dundee It was quite interesting. I remember seeing the first tweet start to get shared quite a lot, and I was like, oh, what's going on here? And I kind of followed it kind of throughout the day, and it was just, it was such a joyous thing to see. And I think that that's something that we definitely don't get enough of in sort of, you know, in politics in general, particularly when it comes to immigration, because it's just seems such a dark topic, and, you know, and it's just there's just no justice in it, you know. But this was real community defiance, it was resistance, it was organic, it wasn't, and it was the politicians came in after, you know, and tried to intervene, and we've seen, you know, real unity on that aspect of things too. So I think it was quite a really, really positive thing for Scotland, for Glasgow specifically, and for the people of Kenmure Street. And I think it was just such a nice, beautiful thing to see. And I think that sort of set the bar as well. So if people start to spot these vans around and things like that, that actually it's not, because if I saw one of those vans, the first thing you want to do now is, right, social media, let's, you know, because one person, what can you do? Well, you can stop it for a while, but you need other people to come and help. And I think the organic community resistance aspect is something that's been missing, particularly since the start of the pandemic, because we've been so separated. So it's really good to see, as things are starting to get more positive, of course there's concerns about the, you know, different variants, but as things start to return back to a bit more freedom, it's nice to see that real community resistance come back again, and hopefully we can start to build on that.
Yeah, I mean, it was great, and I think a lot of people now are educated through that, because now they know what to do if they see a Home Office van. They know to phone the Unity Centre and things will kick on from there. So if you don't feel able to go out and sort of impose yourself, you know, make that phone call, and there is a network now that will spring into action. I think what you might end up seeing happen now is the Home Office will stop using marked vans.
Yeah.
So that might be the next sort of hurdle we overcome.
I just want to give the telephone number for the Unity Centre.
Yep.
It's 0141 427 7992. Even if you don't know where the van is going, someone will come as soon as possible and try to stop the Dawn raid, and that's from No Evictions.
And you can also give them if you just see it driving up one of your streets, and you can grab the registration plate, you can give them that information as well. And just tell them what direction it was going in. You know, if it was on a street heading this way, you know, they can jump in. And I think it's such a nice positive thing there. So hopefully we get to see something else, and hopefully we get to see that intervention. But like David was saying, that, yeah, there'll be a complete redesign of these vans now, and to make them a lot more discreet. To try and stop that doing. So what we need now is the politicians to step up and see, you know, whether it be MSPs and Holyrood, where there's a clear majority to intervene in this and fix it and make it more fair.
Have a more humane system.
Absolutely. But also we need to really point to the Labour Party and opposition parties in Westminster, because this falls on them too, you know, to highlight this. So, you know, it's really good to be, it's been highlighted, it's been resisted by the community. It's now up to the politicians to do what they can to stop this from happening again, and actually have a more humane approach to how we welcome people here.
Yeah, there was speculation online as well that this was some kind of message to the Scottish government, the fact that it was happening on the same day as the swearing in of all the MSPs, that it was in Nicola Sturgeon's constituency, I believe. I'm not sure I buy that, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, we'd have never heard about this. It was only for the actions of, you know, the local neighbours that escalated it into a situation where we all became aware and we all knew it was happening. There's also been I don't know if you've heard of the conspiracy theories flying about it, because the person that made the initial phone call was an SNP activist. So this is somehow proof that it was all staged and Nicola Sturgeon was behind it all. I mean,
that's really something. But I mean, to spot an SNP activist in the south of Glasgow isn't difficult. Do you know what I mean? Like,
there's a few of them kicking about.
There's loads of them, you know, particularly in that sort of area, in Nicola Sturgeon's constituency. So you know, that's a stretch, first of all. But going back to the point that if you think it was linked to the fact the first day of Parliament, I don't think the government is that competent or that, you know, to organise something to be that symbolic. I don't think it's got the capabilities to do that necessarily. But I think as for the wild sort of ideas of, you know, the fact it was an SNP activist who lived with somebody else that was also involved with the SNP, I seen that tweet earlier and I was like, wow. And to get the Home Office to do it on that exact date without a Nicola Sturgeon involved, that's just crazy stuff. But even just looking at, do you think it was convenient, the fact it was the first day of Parliament? It might be, but I really, I don't know, I just don't think that they're that organised. So, you know, I don't think so.
They can't be simultaneously completely inept and also completely brilliant to come up with all these conspiracies, because they also were moving nukes on that day. Did you know that? So that might also be part of the mass conspiracy.
Yeah, I mean, the Tories and Boris are pretty incompetent, but when it comes to doing nasty things, they seem to manage to get their act together when it comes to doing that.
So you think it is a conspiracy, David?
Nah, not really deep down, but like I said, 99 times out of 100, we would have never heard about this happening. The poor guys would be sitting in a cell somewhere now.
Exactly. So,
well done to, I think, the guy Nicholas. Yes with Dex, yeah. Well done to him. Round of applause. Well,
and to the whole community, it's you know, it's a real positive, you know, reflection of that community, but also just how people were sharing it on social media too, and they were getting involved and sending solidarity, you know, I think is such a positive thing. So well done, everybody.
Yeah, and a wee mention for Ungag's Val Wardron, who was on the ground taking part and sending out videos and pictures for us to tweet and raise awareness and try to get something going in social media. So well done, Val.
Thanks, Val.
Well done, Val.
Just talking about congregations and things that happen in the street, I think that brings us on nicely to what was going on in Glasgow over the weekend.
Yeah,
what do you think?
Thursday we saw the sort of best of Glasgow, and then we saw the worst of it over the weekend. You know, just when I thought that we wouldn't have anything else to talk about over the weekend, Rangers got the trophy for winning the league, and their fans decided the best way to celebrate would be, one, to congregate in their thousands in breach of COVID regulations, but also to fight with each other, pee in the street, trash the place, attack the police, you know, the kind of things you do when you're full of joy. I'm a bit biased because I'm a Celtic supporter, so before ending social media starts saying that, I'll put my credentials out there now, but I just want to point out is that in the last 9 years when Celtic were on the league, there's never been a situation where we've thought, let's go and wreck the city centre. Rangers have done it. These Rangers fans have done it, what, 3 times in the last month or 2 months? I mean, what can you say?
Well, see, I feel quite sorry for actual Rangers fans, because they were so joyous. It's, you know, a win that they've wanted for a very long time. And I saw a great celebration, actually. I thought it was really beautiful. It was they all went down to the Clyde with flares, and they were all stood far apart, and they all waved their flares, and it was really visually a stunning celebration of their victory. I don't know if you've seen that. That was the night before the George Square incident. And any Rangers fans that I've spoke to, they've all been really disappointed with the people that went into town and caused all this mayhem. And I even know one that went in to the town thinking, oh, this is going to be great, got into George Square and went, I'm away. Like, they were horrified by what they were seeing. I don't think it's always fair to, like, we know Glasgow's a sectarian city and all that. We know the troubles we've had. but I just think we need to be better. We need to, the Rangers fans who hate seeing all that, they have to come out and make a point of saying, this is not us, this is not representative of our fan base, this is not representative of our club. And the club needs to come out and be like, we don't condone this. But what can you say? I prefer rugby.
The egg chaser's opinion there.
Yes.
I'm not really one for sport at all, right? So I'm just putting my credentials out there and know very little about football in general. But very much what Deborah was saying there, that I know it's not representative of all Rangers fans, and most people would have probably been just as horrified watching that happening as it kind of unfolded and stuff. But my kind of view is that it's like, how many times do we need to have the same conversation? You know, not saying us, but, you know, whether it be the clubs or whether it be, you know, the fans that are just as equally disgusted about people doing stuff like this. It's like, and the poor cleaners and the council workers have to go out and fix it and clean it and put it back to, you know, all these low paid workers having to tidy George Square back again to make it, you know, safe for people to walk through. It's so monotonous, you know, and we need to remember too that I'm from Falkirk originally, and this sectarianism thing echoes all the way through Lanarkshire and out into the central belt too. It seems to stop when it hits West Lothian type of thing, which in itself just shows, you know, it's a huge divide. And I don't know what the answers are. I'm not going to pretend to know what the answers are. I don't know enough about football. I don't know enough about the Old Firm. I don't know enough about that. But it's like, how many times do we need to have this conversation? And how many times do we have to trash George Square before we go, nah, this is just too much? And then just, again, chalk and cheese to throughout so many of the discussions in this podcast today of Westminster versus Holyrood swearing-ins, and now Kenmure Street versus George Square getting trashed. It's like, just constant chalk and cheese.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to tar all Rangers fans with this. I know a lot of Rangers fans that wouldn't take part or wouldn't have anything to do with this kind of behaviour, but I don't see an awful lot of online organised sort of voice for those fans. You know, like most of the sort of loudest voices seem to be the ones they're trying to defend it, or and it's feeds into the whole kind of wider sort of Orange Order, you know, fascistic sort of element that Scotland kind of happy to just sort of ignore a lot of the time. And we kind of keep ignoring it. And I was quite heartened to see some of the statements from Nicola Sturgeon and Humza Yousaf. They were a lot stronger than the previous ones, because I found it quite sickening, some of the statements that go out about it, that they start off with, oh, and first of all, we need well done Rangers and winning the league and stuff. And I'm thinking, well, there's people wrecking the city centre. Do we really need to preface that by congratulating their team? I find that a bit bizarre. And it's, you know, there just seems to be a culture in Scotland of appeasement towards that orange loyalist fascist element. You know, they wrecked the city centre because they felt entitled to. They congregated breaking of the rules because they don't think the rules apply to them. And they have to be held to account, whether it's through their club, whether it's individually. But we have to do something about this. We can't just ignore it and, well, let's cross our fingers and hope they don't do it next July when marching season starts. But
why do we still have orange walks anyway?
I find it fascinating that it's like a caveat in the discussion when we talk about Glasgow as well. But when marching season starts, what? You know, again, coming from Falkirk, we had, you know, I think it was in 2017 or something like that, we had the Grand Lodge march that shut down the whole of Falkirk, and you're just like, it's the walk of the day, as if it's fine.
Which is an Easter parade.
Exactly. You know, it's big in Falkirk, you know, like these types, like, is it just like a festival or whatever? And I just find it really fascinating that we've grown up in this context where it's marching season. I think it's just wild, I think.
Even if we could contain it to like the one day where they, right, okay, we'll give them that day. We'll
just not shut down streets.
But it goes on like the only months. People I know that need to practice walking down a street, they need to practice marches. You know, how hard is it to walk down a street that you need to practice? I've seen marches growing up in Cranmer's Lang, I've seen orange walks in November. So even the concept of marching season's not really true, because they march virtually all year round. They maybe take December off because it's too cold.
I don't see why they can't just go to like Glasgow Green and have a big festival like the Piping Championships, but it's a Orange Walk thing. Like, I actually quite enjoy a bit of a marching band. I just don't like the, you know, heavy sectarian connotations that go along with it.
I would completely agree with that. And it's like, you know, if you want to, you know, if you want to have some kind of marching season, but, you know, cut it right down to a day or 2 days or whatever, and just don't shut down the entire city centre and don't cause these huge, huge issues, you know. And it's, I just find it bizarre that it's just still accepted. I find it really quite odd. But, you know, I would, there's no other group of people or anybody else that I know of that you know, can take up so much space and time. And I think that that's the sort of problematic aspect of it.
I think a lot of it is a throwback to decades and decades ago when there were quite political influence. Where political parties didn't really want to sort of pick a fight with them. But, I mean, I think you're trying to kick in an open door now. Look at these people brawling and pissing over the city centre. These are not people with big political influence. The only political influence they've got is that the political party still believe they've got political power. And I really hope that the statements from Nicola Sturgeon are a sign that, you know, political leaders have had enough of appeasing that element.
I hope so, and I hope that, you know, and, you know, people podcasted in 20, 30 years time aren't they saying, but margin season's coming up, you know. It's like, it would just be nice that, you know, hopefully we kind of move forward from it and it doesn't become such a staple, particularly in Glasgow. It's just, I just think, if you actually explain to somebody, right, I lived in London, right, I lived in Northwest London, right, and see, trying to explain what is going on with these marches to people, and I was they just looked at me as if I was mental, trying to explain this situation, and, you know, the streets being shut down and you can't walk this way because of this, and they're practicing for so long, and they're just like, what?
Don't cross a walk. That's the other one. Don't cross a walk.
And if you do, if you do and you get stabbed, well, it was kind of your fault for trying
it's
to cross the road.
It's your own fault. You get chipped for crossing the walk.
You know, like, I think in Scotland, you know, we tell ourselves these stories about how, you know, progressive we are and things like that, but it is a huge orange elephant in the room. And there's aspects of Scottish society that I don't think we think about. Like, Brian, when you lived in London, did you know the religion and all your friends?
Not necessarily, no. And I think...
Whereas growing up in Scotland, even though you might be, like, you don't need to be a bigot, but you kind of always know what your religion, different friends are.
And it always comes down to what school you went to. You
know. Yeah, what school
partly
do you
that
go
as well. Well, that's a countdown before the destruction in George Square starts getting blamed in Catholic schools. That's usually how these cycles go, in my opinion. But yeah, it kind of shows you that sort of element exists in the background of Scottish society, even in the section of Scottish society where you would say, well, you know, religion and sectarianism isn't irrelevant, but, you know, I knew the religion of every one of my friends growing up, whereas that's no normal. Maybe it is in other parts like Northern Ireland, but it's no normal in, I think, most of, say, England or other parts of the world.
And especially in Scotland, though, when you look at the recent polls and stuff, like over 50% of people don't recognize themselves to be a member of religion. So a member of religion, what? You don't remember, you know, you're not non-religious, you know, they're not religious. So it is wild, isn't it, that, yeah, because for me, I mean I was never religious anyway, and, you know, one of my parents is Catholic and one of them's Protestant, so, you know, it's always interesting. But it's like, I was just more worried about, you know, being a gay person in a religious setting, you know, let alone what religion it was.
Yeah, well, I kind of think of myself as being ethnically Catholic. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. I don't want anything particularly to do with the Catholic Church, but I could still get beat up for being a Fenian bastard.
You have to cut that one as well.
Well, bleep it.
Bleep it. Bleep. I suppose I'm a good Protestant in the sense that I go to church for weddings or christenings or funerals, but that's about it. I don't go any other time. Oh, I went to an Easter service. That was nice. But my God is Mother Nature, so I suppose I'm a pagan. Is that what
pagan?
I don't know. I'm not really into religion in that way. I think it's probably a product of going to primary and secondary school in Glasgow. Like, that's probably why I don't want anything to do with it. Somebody asks you what team you support.
I'm just excited for the next podcast when I can put in your intro the good Protestant.
The good Protestant.
Yeah. But it is crazy that, you know, regardless to what, you know, your upbringing was quite rooted in religion. You know, I went to a school which was clearly more prominent Protestant, and you know, and now you can rhyme off all these different hymns and stuff, and yet they're talking about the fact that, you know, the Thai campaign is trying to indoctrinate people. Well, hang on a minute here. If we can, you know, at the age of 35, remember all of these different hymns and you know, sermons and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it was supposed to be a non-denominational school as well, my school. And yet we had a minister come in, say the Lord's Prayer and all the rest of it. And every child in the school went to the Sunday school, went to the Brownies, to the Girl Guides. I was told recently that the Boys Brigade is a very Protestant thing, is that right?
Apparently so. And I was in the Boys Brigade and I didn't know that. So.
You were getting indoctrinated. That's what was happening.
Of course, yeah. I just thought because it was Banson on Monday night at the school.
I went to the Boys Brigade, would actually challenge that notion, except I remember thinking, why am I the only one from my school with this? So maybe there is something in that. And I do remember saluting a flag every week that I presume was a Union mm-hmm. Jack, so...
Well,
I definitely regret that.
but what's interesting at school too is thinking, you know, this is like late 80s into early 90s, and it's like, you know, we had some people in our class and we were learning about, you know, we had a class member who was from Pakistan, who was Muslim, and we were actually learning how to write Urdu and stuff, which I thought was amazing and great. But then, of course, we went to hymn practice, and all of these students who were from a different religion or anything sat at the back on their own and read a book whilst we all sang songs. And I was like, ugh, you know, thinking about that is just horrible. You know,
And that is a bit of the debate as well, because when they talk about religion in schools, the debate immediately goes to Catholic schools as if the non-denominational schools are these sort of bastions of secularism, which they're clearly not.
Yes, well, so it was a while ago for me. I don't know if it's changed. You know, again, this is a whole pod on its own, isn't it? Talking about education and religion. But yeah, it's just interesting. Let's just not exclude people, basically.
Exactly.
In any way, you know, let's have inclusive education across the board, whether it be gender, sexuality, religion, anything. Just be inclusive.
And on that note, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. We're a bit over time and I need to take my cat to the vet. So,
Well, so, I think that was a great point to end on.
Yep. So, Emda, you can find us online at leftungagged.org. Find us on Twitter and Facebook. Our Twitter handle is @_ungagged. And if you want to follow me, you can find me at DevoMC82. Deborah, do you want to say bye?
Yes, you can follow me if you want. I'm Heath P. Picked on Twitter.
Hello, and not hello, goodbye. Thanks very much for listening. You can follow me on Twitter if you want. I'm @WeSociologist.
All right. Thanks, guys. It's been a great pod, and I'll speak to you again next week. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Our outro music this week is a powerful song by Loud Women. It's called Reclaim These Streets. Go and check it out. All the downloads you give it plays, streams. The profits go to Women's Aid Charity. It was written by Cassie Fox, who we hope to have on the podcast soon. We can talk about it more. But for now, enjoy the song.
text me when you get home.